Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Steve Mathiasen from Mathiasen Wines in California. We'll talk to Steve about Farmers First, sustainability, Mathiasen wines, and more. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Steve Mathiasen studied philosophy in college, but thankfully moved on to horticulture in grad school at UC Davis, finding his way into vineyards and orchards, working for a small sustainable agriculture firm. Steve started consulting on vineyard practices and helped co-write the book on these practices in California. In 2003, Steve started primarily focusing on his family farm and winemaking operation, Mathiasen Wines. The San Francisco Chronicle and Food and Wine magazine named Steve Winemaker of the Year. Viticulture and horticulture are just as important to Steve as grapes and winemaking. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Steve.
Thank you.
Steve, you know, I've been chasing you around probably a good 6-7 months already, and ironically, I get to meet up with you down at the Charleston Wine and Food Festival, which is my pleasure, you know, to sit with you. But I was hoping to get you in studio or maybe to get you to call in, but you know, it's great to have you here. So thank you for sitting with us. I wanted to give the audience a sense of who you are and where you came from. Let's not assume everybody, you know, knows that. So give me a quick background in your journey in life and in wine that got you pretty much to where you are now, which is, you know, Mathiasen Wines. We could start, you were born in Canada.
Yeah, there you okay. go. Yeah, I mean, right now we're a small family business. My wife and I own it and run it, and we farm grapes, and we farm some other crops, some fruit trees, sell them in the farmer's market, make jams, and then we make wine and sell our wine. And we have two sons.
But do they help out with
our sons do help out. They help out more at the farmer's market. They help out. When they were little, if they wanted money, their friends were over, I'd say, no problem, I'll give you a nickel a vine if you tie the vine up, or if you, you know, just give them a job and pay them. You had to pay them. We call it piece rate in agriculture,
right?
Because it keep them motivated. But yeah. So you know. So they've always helped out. And one's in college now. One's in high school, and they're figuring out what they're going to do with their lives.
Do you sense they have any interest in coming back with you?
Well, the older one right now. They're planning on going out into the world, but. But the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree. The older one's in college, is into sustainable agriculture. He's living in this house in college that has the student farm. It's the house that had the student farm. He's, they're cooking. He's stealing.
Sounds a little familiar.
Yeah, exactly. Right? He's stealing juice from the cafeteria and fermenting it in his room.
Wow, that's funny.
He's too cheap to go buy. He's like, why would I go buy this terrible beer when I can just make terrible alcohol for free with juice from the cafeteria?
There you go. Well, go backwards for me a little, because you brought up a point about your son and you. I mean, I think you're a horticulturist and a viticulturist first.
Yeah.
You know, I think the farming thing. And, I mean, you went to college to go to college, but fortunately, I think, what'd you study, philosophy?
Yeah.
You didn't stay on that course.
Yeah.
You kind of found your love. So just kind of walk me through there. It was UC Davis. And
well, I went to, I mean, so I went to the philosophy and the little liberal arts school, but we had a garden in the yard. When I was a kid, that's when I started being fascinated with farming and farming, farms.
But where? Because if you grew up in the Bronx, that could be hard.
Well, it was hard, though, because I grew up in Winnipeg, which is an urban city.
Right.
But I had my great aunt lived in North Dakota, and we would visit her every single summer and stay out. That was very rural. And go visit the old family farm there. And
that was like a sandbox and a toolbox for you.
Oh, yeah. She had a riding mower, and she'd always, like, save lawn mowing for when I got there so I could mow her lawn and stuff. And we'd go out, and I'd go out and walk into the wheat fields and just kind of commune with the openness and emptiness and climb on the tractors and stuff. And then my parents split up when I was 7, and I got shipped off for the summer up to, as it was leading up to them splitting up, I got shipped off up to my cousin's farm in Manitoba, which is where Winnipeg is. And that was a wheat, so I spent that time. And then, when my parents split up and we moved down, my mom and my sister and I moved down to Tucson, Arizona.
That's another interesting kind of
Rolling,
not farmland, but
But it's all about terrain, the outdoors, open, big sky, you see the rocks, the cactus. And I had pretty bad ADD and went to a special unstructured school that was kind of out in the desert, and they had goats and chickens, and every kid had one row in the garden. It was like a hippie school. This was in the 70s.
Love that, though.
I loved it. Yeah, so it's, then it was just out. So I was either out in the desert roaming around with my friends, or with the horses or the goats, or planting radishes and what have you. And so that just kind of so that always carried through. But then you think, so I go to college, and it wasn't, it hadn't occurred to me that you could be a farmer, right? When you're a city kid like that, even though I had those experiences out on the farm, it wasn't my direct family. It was my cousins. And so, so I went to college and but I didn't really have a career path or any real interest, because the only thing I cared about
was undergrad. You went to college.
Undergrad,
nothing to do with any
undergrad,
of these
I studied philosophy.
Didn't you go where Nixon went?
Yeah, Nixon went there, but it was a Quaker school, though. It was
a lot in common there, right?
Yeah. So we had our garden. I brewed beer, drank wine, and we cooked a lot. I lived in my buddies and I lived in this rented this house. And we cooked a lot, and I figured, I was majoring in philosophy because I'm not going to be a doctor, or a lawyer, or engineer, any of that stuff. Because really, the only thing I care about is growing things and making beer and good meals, right? And so when I got out, moved to San Francisco and worked as a bike messenger and had a garden and kept making beer and kept drinking what wine I could afford. And then I found out about UC Davis, that they had an agriculture school.
It's like the Mecca.
Yeah, and somehow I just didn't know that. And so when I found out about it, I immediately applied and managed to get in to study international agricultural development. I was planning to travel to third world countries and try to work with organic farming.
You must have shit when you got there.
Oh, it was
like everything I
wanted. It was everything. I was looking at the catalog. I remember going to the library and in San Francisco. This is pre-internet, right? So you had to go to the library and look at the course catalog, and we're thumbing through the pages, and I'm going, holy crap, a whole department called soil science? They have usually the course is soil microbiology.
One man's porn is another man's soil.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. I couldn't believe it. There's a department of plant pathology, just a whole department just studying the diseases of plants. I got there, said I'm going to learn everything I can about organic farming, and got an internship working for a consulting company, in the Central Valley of California that focused on helping growers reduce their pesticide use, and they worked in almonds, peaches, walnuts, and wine grapes.
It's an interesting story because it's a big commodity farm, and
yeah.
Why would they give a crap about sustainability? But that's where you came in and helped
yeah.
them and kind of wrote the book about it, right?
Yeah, well, eventually, yeah, because actually, so I ended up staying with that consulting company for 4 more years, and then after I got out of graduated, got my master's from Davis and stayed with them, and then it was small family. A lot of their clients were small family farmers, and then
right.
they had some big guys.
It was a large area, but it was made up of
all different sizes yeah. of farmers,
which yep. kind of plays to your passion.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yep. And so that's when I was at that point. I'm not making beer anymore. I'm making wine because I'm just getting grapes out of the places that, where I worked.
Can you clear something up for me at some point in doing a little research? I read that your wife Jill hired you as an intern at some point. Is that true? Is that this or somewhere else?
So yes and no.
Okay.
Because the internship was with this consulting company that worked on the tree fruit and the grapes, and the money they got to hire me was from a grant. They were hired on as the consulting company for this grant for reducing pesticide use in almond orchards. And she was working for a nonprofit that got the grant, and she was administering
ah.
it. So it was their decision whether or not to hire me, but her chime in vote was, why would you hire him? He has no experience.
It's cute.
She has been the business mind in our business the entire time.
Yeah. Well,
I get the stupid ideas, and she says, why would you do that?
Gladly, you have somebody who
does
that.
And then if you fight for it and she gives in, usually, then it's a good idea.
So with all that work, you wound up writing about sustainability in a manual, and it was
yeah.
adopted by the state, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I left down there. I left, and we ended up working for the Lodi Wine Grape Commission, and we write this manual on sustainable practices.
And not long after, you became a consultant and then moved towards your own direction.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Worked doing research for a winery called R.H. Phillips back then. Before they were an independently owned winery back then. They were big, but they were independently owned at that time.
Right.
And then went to Napa and started our own business.
Which was when? About 02, 03?
02, January of 02.
All right, so we'll kind of take it from there. But I want to sort of get into a couple of mindsets that you have. You know, you say wine is made in the vineyard and farmers first, which everything you've done kind of leads to that mentality. Explain that, because a lot of people think wine's made in the cellar
I think most wine people agree that the terroir defines the style of the wine, hopefully, right? You can mess with it in the cellar, but basically by the terroir. My take on that is yes, but because I really think that the craft of viticulture, the human aspect of farming the grapes, that's what is when you say we're making the wine, because the site kind of is what it is, and you know it's going to have certain characteristics, but within that there's still a huge range of what the wine's going to be like, how good it's going to be, and how consistent it's going to be, and that's where the farming comes in. And so when we say we're making wine, like right now in springtime in Napa, you know, I was busy leading up to coming here for this trip because we've been organizing, getting going on mowing and disking our cover crops and finishing pruning. And all three of those, I consider those winemaking. So like the cover crops
but it's also sustainability stuff.
Sustainability and good wine generally in the vineyard, those are all.
But not everyone practices. I mean, we're sitting here with our friend Nathan Roberts, who agrees with everything you say. Not everyone does it, but... But that's where, you know, the farming part comes
in. So like the cover crop is a perfect example where it's sustainable. You need a cover crop, making sure there's stuff growing between the vines is for sustainability, better water infiltration, less soil erosion, less carbon footprint, sequestering carbon, habitat, all that stuff for sustainability. But for wine quality, that's how you adjust the vigor of the vine, which is critical for wine quality. So like right now, when we're making the wine this year, because I'm looking at the soil moisture, looking at the weather, and the blocks of grapes we want to reduce the vigor on, so which will improve our wine quality,
so
we're leaving the cover crop in.
That's not too nerdy, but explain to the listeners. You want to reduce the vigor. which means
so to the
you
listeners,
don't want the grape or the
grapevine has to grow a certain amount,
right? Naturally,
if the grapevine grows too much, we call that too vigorous. It grows too much, too strong. Then what you do is you get diluted, weak,
takes away from the quality of the fruit.
Yeah, you get really weak wine. If it doesn't grow enough, you get weak wine that's also bitter, weak in a different way. Rather than being like lacking in everything and kind of watery, if it's too low in vigor, it's kind of, you get a real hollow and kind of bitter nastiness, not very fruity, not good.
Right.
If they're just grows just right, that's when you have the generous, nice, rich, complete wine. And so with viticulture, we're all year looking at the vine and thinking, okay, how do we help these vines grow more? And these vines, how do we get these vines to not grow so much? And so in the spring, when our cover crop is taking water out of the soil, and so it's competing with the vines.
Which
so
you want.
We want if they're too strong.
Because you don't want as much water, so it wouldn't be too vigorous.
Yeah.
Right.
But if they're not vigorous enough, then we want to
get them out of there.
We
got to
get the cover crop out of there. So that's why we're making the wine right now, even though it's springtime.
Right. I guess it's fair to ask this. I mean, climate change, too little rain, too much rain, fires. I mean, has that changed the way you plant and farm? I mean, you just said that you have to kind of control the vigor season by season.
Yeah.
But I'm talking the bigger picture, you know, the dome above all of that.
Yeah.
I mean, are you doing different practices
for climate
now?
For climate change, we're totally changing how we do things.
Give me an example.
Okay, so planting a new vineyard, we're using way more vigorous rootstocks. The whole trend for the last 20, 30 years was lower vigor rootstocks for better wine quality. But now I'm planting very vigorous rootstocks. And then hoping that we can use vigorous native grasses to hold the vigor down, but that way they have deep roots so they can handle more and more droughts and heat events coming down the road.
So the root system gives them more survivability or better in that condition.
Yeah, it used to be you wanted a shallow root system that you could control. Now we're going for, so I've changed that, going for a deep root system so the vine can withstand, you know, bad weather conditions.
So if I'm a winery and I want to take you on as a consultant and I say to you, these are the type of wines I want to grow, is the way you want to grow it, would that potentially net a different product than what I'm looking for? Like you and I could sort of have a clash?
No, because most of the consulting I do, because I still do a lot of consulting for other wineries.
Right.
And a lot of them have different styles of wine than what I have, but a healthy, balanced vine is a healthy, balanced vine. So 98% of it is the same no matter what style of wine you're trying to make. Most of my clients would like to have their alcohols a little lower, and they're working on it.
Is it fair to say that's why they come to you? Because they know that's kind of where your head is at?
I think that's fair to say,
If they want a big alcohol, but I have some opulent wine, you ain't the guy.
Well, I do have clients who make pretty big, high-alcohol, opulent wines, but they still... there's still stuff I can help them with in the vineyard.
I'm not knocking big, high out, you know. Yeah. I mean,
but because the viticulture, I had someone in New York saying, like, how is it that, because some of my clients, though, have never even tasted their wines, believe it or not.
I believe it.
And because it's irrelevant, it was so much, and a guy in New York saying, well, how can that be? Don't you have to taste, know where you're going with the wine? It's like, well, but healthy, balanced wines, that's a fundamental.
Right.
Right?
At the very least from you.
Yeah.
They'll get their style, but they'll get...
They can work on
the viticulture.
When they're going to pick the grapes, they can pick it riper. That's up to them, you know. And if I know they're going to pick it riper, we might do a few things differently. But mainly, balanced vines. Because a lot of it is that end of the vineyard, the vines are sick. Why are they sick? That end of the vineyard, they're growing too much. You know, these are not... wine style questions. These are farming questions. So we need to deal with all that stuff. And so a lot of times it's basics like that, trying to get the vineyard even. And then so it's not really a wine quality issue.
Right. So
it becomes a wine quality issue, but not a wine style issue is what I mean to say. It's a wine quality issue, but not a wine style issue.
So you're consulting multiple vineyards. So you have to find time, balance your time. I would assume you have a business that pays the bills. Plus, I know you're making a lot of different wines, which takes up time. How do you split your time?
Got a great partner in Jill to keep me on
track. The business part,
she takes the business parts taken care of. And And on our side, we have a great team. It used to be a lot harder when I was doing a lot more of it myself. And now, you know, I get to be a little more of the coach. But it's really hard to split my time. But unfortunately, we didn't start with any money. And so that we've always, the consulting, we have to do the consulting, right? Because we're trying, still building our business. We just bought our winery this year. And we bought a new vineyard with the winery on it. This is a big thing for us.
So we'll get into that in a few minutes.
Because when I was a kid, when we moved down to Tucson, we were in a trailer park. Just to put it in perspective.
Okay.
So it's like, how do you split your time? It's like, it's not by choice. Right. But, you know, we need to keep...
You do what you got to do.
Yeah, exactly. So you just make it work.
You know, I want to talk to you about Matthias and all the wines, the whole model and all that. But are you a guy that holds farming in the field to a higher calling than actually winemaking in the cellar? Or I know it's a loaded question.
I love them both, but let's just say that in terms of the complexity and the time to learn, it's 80% field, 20% cellar.
Nathan, do you agree? I mean, are you 60-40 or you similar practices?
Well, I'm not sure I understand the question. I mean, I think fundamentally that the vineyard is much more complex than the
right.
cellar work.
And you spend a lot of time there. It's important.
Yes,
it's
course,
not grow the grapes, let's get them in there, make wine.
No.
It's grow the... Right.
Exactly.
So it is, at the very least, an equal, but to you, and I'm sure Nathan, it's the farming and the viticulture.
Yeah, I mean, the entire wine business is complex with the sales and packaging, figuring out corks and stuff. But I guess, you know, but the winemaking, I mean, the vineyard side is just, this sort of complex, multi-headed beast that you will
right.
never in your lifetime feel like you've mastered.
Way more facets to that.
Yeah, it's just
than
so many,
what you
there's
need
just so
to
many
have
facets
to do in
with the
cellar.
Living plants and soil.
You agree, Nathan? Just way more stuff going on out in the farm
definitely.
Than in the cellar.
I mean, and just dealing with things that are out of your control with the weather and the
right.
seasons and
right, yeah.
you know, 1 year versus the next.
But not
in the vineyard is.
But
you know,
not everybody so. Looks at the way you guys do. Not everybody in a good way fixates on it. You know,
yeah.
they just do it and
they
move
bring
on.
Me the grapes.
Yeah. Do you guys see yourselves as sort of individualists in Napa? I mean, Napa's not that old, but it's somewhat homogenous in what they've been doing. I mean, you're kind of bucking the trend a little. Nathan's bucking the trend a little.
I mean...
Do you...
I would feel like...
First of all, do you give a shit? Probably not.
Well, kind of... Yeah, I mean... Kind of know. I mean, I've always been an individualist. When I was a skateboarder, I was against the homogenization of skateboarding tricks, just to put it in perspective. Okay, and so because they would be so trendy and when everyone's you know, and so it's so that's where my head's how I'm wired, right? And so it's nothing about you know. So I could be making wine in Beaujolais or Burgundy or Napa or anything else. For me personally. I would be bucking the trend. It's how I'm wired.
You did it more because right
because it's
way
how I want to do it.
You know, just to show them right.
Well, yeah, it's not necessarily as a rebel thing, but I just do what I want to do. I don't really consider what other people are doing,
right?
And you know, but wine regions are conformist anywhere in the world. One of the reasons that George Vare brought the Rebola Gialla over was because Rebola Gialla is which we love Rebola Gialla. Make Rebola Gialla that. Is one of the few wine varieties that in its place of origin, people do different things, wildly different things.
Right.
You know, so many wine regions, it's like they're just, it's just part of our human nature, I guess. Is
perfect grape to bring here and do what you want with it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
So it represents a level of freedom and nonconformity.
All right, let's talk about Matthias and wines a little. We're talking to Steve Matthias, and we're also sitting at the table. We've been graced by... Nathan Roberts and Harry Root, who's a guy who's been able to get a lot of good wine into town through the years as a importer distributor. I think both you guys like to make wines you like to drink, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that sort of
bottom line.
It's like, what do I like to drink?
Yeah.
That's what I'm going to go make and all
yeah.
of that. Is that a fair statement
oh, yeah.
and all that? So you have a philosophy and a mantra for the type of grapes you grow. The wines that you want to make. So let's start with that. Low alcohol wines.
Okay.
What's a Matthias in profile? And then we'll get into the fact that you're doing a million grapes.
Yeah,
like
we're okay. And all that. Well, I mean, I think that we're very focused on the grape tasting like the varietal. And that comes, again, out of a horticulture tradition. You know, if you're growing like I'm fascinated with the variety, right? If you're a gardener and you have your heirloom tomatoes, you're fascinated with the different heirlooms, the marble stripe, et cetera, and how do they grow, what do they taste like, et cetera. And so I'm really fascinated with the grape variety. That's, for me personally, more of a fascination than the soil per se. The soil's important, the site's important, but my fascination is the grape, the heritage, these are all heirlooms that we're growing, these grape varieties. They go back hundreds and hundreds of years, and so I like for our wines that if it says Chardonnay, it tastes like Chardonnay in a classic sense, not a spoofed up Chardonnay, but just a nice pure. What does that grape actually taste like? Hopefully, the sense of eating the grape carries through the fresh fruits.
Do you use oak for your Chardonnay?
We do, and well, it depends on the Chardonnay. We have three single vineyard Chardonnays, and two of them have a little bit of oak. One has no oak, but they're all fermented in oak barrels, but two of them has a little new oak. The other has no new oak. But I think that a little oak in the right Chardonnay is traditional with Chardonnay.
Right.
So, but the idea is not to mask the Chardonnay, but lift it, right?
Right.
But alcohol levels and good fresh acidity and moderate alcohol is really important to me. You know, and
freshness.
Freshness, yeah,
acidity
absolutely. Freshness
makes the wine interesting. Good food wine.
Yeah, food compatibility is paramount. You know, and so that comes with the good if it tastes like the grape and it has good fresh acidity and moderate alcohol, the chances are it's going to go with food. You know,
this may be a silly question, but is there a threshold on the alcohol? It's like, I ain't going over 13, 13 and a half. Does that create a wine that ultimately is not going to be what you like to drink? Or it depends on the grape, the wine,
no,
or you don't get there often?
I rarely have to fight that because all the work we do in the vineyard, I'm happy with to pick the grapes before the sugars get too high.
So talk about that a little. You tend to pick early.
Yeah.
And the reason is
it
helps you get to the style, but explain why.
Yeah, I mean, picking early allows the alcohol to be moderate, the acidity to be there, the flavors to be fresher. I don't get like with our wines, I do not like them to let them get into any kind of jammy or cooked flavors at all.
So that's the flip
side. I want fresh, crunchy flavors.
If they sit on the vine,
yeah,
they'll get sweeter. The bricks will go up. That'll create a jamminess. The alcohol will go up.
Yeah, exactly. And all of that stuff is like, I don't want to go there. I'm trying to capture it at the peak where it's still fresh and like, you know, crunchy, like crunching into an apple. That's how the sensation we want with our wines. Our wines are not a stewed pear.
Right.
It's a crunchy, hard apple. So that all goes with alcohol. But also it's important to me health-wise that the alcohol is moderate, you know, so I make a point of grabbing the fruit before the alcohol is going to be high because I don't want high alcohol. You know, we have alcoholism in our family. I actually get headaches from overly ripe wines, especially overly ripe red wines. I want to make a wine that's everything we've been doing is about organic farming. My wife worked for 12 years in the local food movement.
Right.
In Northern California. You know, our wine, if you can imagine like farm to table, imagine that ethic. What food would you have at a good farm to table restaurant buying from local chefs? That's what our wine distilled in there. That's the ethic.
Right.
That's the whole ethos.
So let's talk about physical property. I mean, you own land, you contract some grapes. Now's the time to talk about the fact that you have a winery now.
Mm-hmm.
So just tell me, the wines that you're making are coming from where? I know that behind your house you have vines and property. I know the woman who owns the house next to the property, you buy grapes and all that. But where is everything coming from right now?
Okay, so we own two vineyards. We lease.
Those are contiguous to the
house? No, two different. One at the house, one at where the winery is. And then we lease seven vineyards. So the leases are basically long-term arrangements where it's a true lease is if you're leasing a retail space or something, we operate it. It's our vineyard. It's an estate vineyard. We farm it organically, and we pay a rent check to the owner. So it's our employees,
but she's sort
our tractors.
Of a partner. I mean, she buys into.
They're a tenant. The owners tenant. Are all. Are, oh, sorry. The, we're tenants. The owners tenant. Are landlords.
But she gets what you're doing.
Oh yeah, they all do.
Yeah.
They all do, you know, it's, most of our leases are actually like retirement homes and or second homes in Napa. There's a vineyard there, and they would have hired someone to farm it for them. We lease it, so it's great because it's a way that we can have. Expand our estate vineyards without having to come up with the cash.
Think about what it takes to swim a coastline longer than the entire eastern seaboard and leap tall waterfalls in a single bound. What does it take to survive 200 feet deep in icy salt water? What would you be made of? Wild Alaska Seafood is made of tight muscle mass, long-chain omega-3s, and incredible micronutrients. It matters where your food comes from. Experience the flavor of the fittest in every bite and enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. Ask for Alaska on the menu, grocery store, or smart device. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
Feed a girl from the finger bowl. Next time you step up.
So, Steve, we were talking about a property and the winery. The winery is a recent acquisition, right?
Yeah.
So that is a physical structure or something you're building?
The physical structure.
What it is. Just give me a
little bit. Well, the winery is a... It's a simple little winery that the family we bought it from, they built it themselves.
Where is it exactly?
Themselves. It's about a mile west of us on Dry Creek Road. Napa has a Dry Creek Road as well. And right up against the hills, town of Napa.
It is the town of Napa.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's less than a mile from our house.
Right.
And, you know, it was mothballed, really neat couple. He built it himself with his own hands, and so we were leasing the vineyard next door, so I got to know him. He didn't want to sell it to someone who's going to just build some giant McMansion and giant architect design winery, and he was kind of land rich, cash poor at that point. You know, it was always a sideline, and his main job was as a surveyor. He's working kind of guy, and so we connected and really liked each other, and we offered him a lifetime estate so that way they could, you know, he and his wife can live on that property for as long as they live. And then because we already have a house, it worked out perfectly. So that got the price down to where we could afford it.
Smart setup.
Yeah. And so we redid the inside in terms of electrical, compressed air, all
this
stuff.
So you're not doing much with the building. You're updating.
We just make
the flow to how you want to, you know,
exactly
work and
right.
make wine and
yep.
all of that.
Yeah. Because we just needed to update it. It's simple. It's exactly our style. It has a 30-year-old Cabernet vineyard on it, which we're really happy about.
So two things. It sounds like you're trying to get to like a vineyard own model. Right?
Would yeah, I mean, that's really the
but
model.
But I need you to explain to people what a vineyard own model is. It's a European thing.
It's
but
more,
it's not what you're doing now, but it's a place you want to get to. And it's
I mean, I kind of feel like we're there in the sense that now is that, you know, we were always stuck on the vineyard on, you know, the idea that you farm your own vineyard and then make the wine yourself. And it's one continuous process from pruning the vines to selling the wine. And everything
total
in between.
Total vertical,
right? And so,
and making a living off of it,
yeah,
hopefully.
And feeding your family,
right.
And that's and so, you know, we had the vineyard side, which is actually kind of unusual now for in California, but you know we were renting space, custom crushing for the wine side. So now that we got the winery, you know, we're there. I feel we're, you know, I mean, I there's not, in terms of what I'm trying to achieve. And now we're there. You know, we have the vineyards, we have the winery.
When
it's
are you
working.
Gonna, are you or when are you going to make your first wines?
This fall we did. 2017, yeah.
So the first vintage in the new winery is
2017.
2017,
yeah. And we got everything picked before the fires. And, you know, it actually turned out to be a great year for us.
For you personally had no
Yeah, for us personally, no major. It was freaky at the time, and it was horrible.
Oh, sure.
But we escaped it, so.
Anybody close or everybody in that general
I have some clients that got, you know, got hit.
Wow.
But you know, our area, we were okay, so we're fortunate.
All right, so let's talk about, so now you have your winery, you have your property. Are you and can you get into an acquisition mode for more property?
No,
the acquisition part is money, so I'm not going to take that for granted.
No,
but
we
are you at a place where you're farming what you...
We don't want, you know, now that we got the last piece of the puzzle was the winery, and we're very conscious about, like, our, you know, our goals and, you know, and our what we want out of this business. And, you know, and if we grow anymore, we're going to start being... I don't want to be a manager, you know. I like farming and winemaking.
You found the spot that you want to stay in.
Yeah.
No temptation?
No, not
more
really.
More wine, more money, you know, more...
No, because if we got more money, we would, you know, we don't need anything anymore.
Right.
We're all set.
Right.
So now we're just trying to keep... We just want to... If we can just keep going, then we're doing
just
great.
Just a side business question. I know you have to invest capital in the winery to get it up and running, but once it's running, is there a savings vinting your own wine versus going out?
That's a good question, and I've penciled it out a few times, and not really.
Okay. It's yours.
Yeah, but it's yours.
That's worth
it's worth
penny.
It for the control.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about diversity grapes. So you got the properties, you got your winery now, which really, I mean, it's not even a year old. You, as much or more than anyone, are growing some of the craziest variety of grapes. You, not alluded, you mentioned one earlier, Ribolla Giallo. How many different grapes are you growing? What are you vinting? You know, does it change every season based on weather or whim or?
Mm-hmm. Well, we grow some and we have some that's a little bit removed. It's all kind of concentric circles. So the stuff we grow doesn't change every year because we're growing it.
Like Chardonnay is an important crop.
Yeah, so like we have like Chardonnay, Cabernet, Merlot, Cabernet Franc. We do a fair amount of Cabernet Franc. Petit Verdot, Malbec, these are the ones we grow.
Right.
Ribolla Giallo, Rifosco, Schioppettino. So those are the ones on the properties that we own.
How many of those are individual bottlings? Like you have a Ribolla bottling?
Yeah, we have
you
a Ribolla.
You have a Schioppettino bottling?
We have a Schioppettino bottling.
You do, okay.
And a Rifosco bottling. We'll be pouring the Rifosco tomorrow here at the festival. And we do a Cab Franc bottling as well as Cab Franc goes into our
blending
blend.
Right.
We do a straight up Cabernet Franc. We also put Cabernet Franc into our red wine.
Right.
But then we have vineyards that I manage. So it's not a lease, but they hire me to manage it, or it's still an arrangement where I'm managing it.
Separate than the consulting thing?
Kind of separate because it's...
But do you have access to those grapes?
Yeah, so that's the...
You split, they take some, you get some?
Well, yeah, like for example, in Rutherford we have a vineyard that has Greco, that we planted, that has Greco di Tufo.
That's a cool grape.
It has Grenache, Syrah, Mourvèdre, and it has Cab Franc. And that is... and that's in Rutherford. So we planted it, I manage that, But then it's not a lease. What we do is we pay them, our rent is we pay them some of the wine back.
Wine or grapes?
Wine. So we give them some. They
That's
have their,
the deal.
Some of their wine back for their.
So
under
keeps
their label.
Their property, their investment vibrant. It's productive.
Yeah.
They see your efforts in their product.
They love it.
As a finished product. It works for everybody.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, as we were talking earlier about horticulture and viticulture, to be able to get your hands on that many different varieties.
Oh, it's so cool.
I mean, you must be having...
And then out in the Dunnigan Hills, there's a vineyard that they hired me to as their consultant. And I trained the vineyard manager.
Where are the Dunnigan Hills?
Dunnigan Hills is about an hour inland from Napa, so it's a lot hotter.
Right.
and it's really cool, gravelly kind of hillside, very low fertility, very hot. And out there we have, that's for our other brand, Tendu.
So yeah, I wanted to talk to you a little about that.
So they hired me.
So while we're on that. So that's different properties. You're not growing Tendu behind the house
or
whatever.
No, Tendu works better.
It's a value wine that's made. Tell people what Tendu is.
So Tendu is a red and a white. They're really bright, clean, crisp, low alcohol, good table wines.
Extraordinarily drinkable.
Extraordinarily drinkable.
And they come in an interesting bottle.
They come in a 1 liter bottle with a beer cap on it.
Right.
And we really love the beer cap because it's just fun.
Are they vintage years?
Yeah, they're vintage.
Right.
Yeah, they're vintage years. And they're about, these are red and white that are both about 11% alcohol usually.
Easy drinking.
The red is unsulfured and unfiltered.
And are those some of the farms out in Dunnigan Hills?
Yeah, so those are the Tendu.
Yeah. Okay.
And so that would be an example where they hired me as a consultant. We planted all these grapes. We hired a vineyard manager who used to be a truck driver. I trained him on how to be a vineyard manager.
Great story.
So now we buy the grapes from them, but I feel comfortable because I trained the vineyard manager. So I know exactly what's going on. We have a great relationship, and it's my way of doing things. They're in transition right now to organics. That was the last step.
What's the genesis of that? Here's an opportunity to make a value wine with all your practices and sensibilities, all the qualities, offer it at a good price and make it drinkable. I mean, was that a business thing, a business extension thing, a passion? Did you want to prove to yourself, here's the best damn bottle of wine at this price you're going to taste?
It was kind of all of the above. Earlier we were talking about making the wine you want to drink. And we love drinking beautiful, really light-bodied, crisp wines. And we kind of thought, they're hard to find. They're actually hard to find.
And if you're drinking it every night, every other night,
you don't
want to lay down a lot of money. So,
And I wanted to have a wine that's affordable. Anybody can
buy.
So
you were motivated to make that product.
The price point was really important. We want a wine that people grab with their groceries, but it's handmade. And without a bunch of chemicals. It's nice, real wine.
It's very critically acclaimed for the type of wine it is, for the price point. Well, all the characteristics you describe are there, and I think that's, why it's popular.
Talking to Eric Asimov about it, his point was that so many inexpensive wines are trying to be cheap versions of expensive wines rather than... Whereas there's a style of wine, an inexpensive wine, that if it just is true to what it is, it's not trying to be a fancy wine. We don't, it's just saying I'm a nice, simple, drinkable wine.
But there's a lot of connections because Eric did an article about a month ago, his annual article about great wines for about $20.
Mm-hmm.
And he prefaced it by saying, you can get wines for less. But they're not made by farmers. They're manufactured. You're just not going to find the quality, and the value. He said you have to start at a certain price point and you will find, and that goes back to you, guys that are farming it, that have a style, that put their heart into it. And I think Tendu falls right in that, category. Here's a great wine at a great price with, all the great qualities. And I think Eric recognizes that. As much as anybody.
He sees when someone's trying to make the wine into something it's not, that's a big turnoff to him, as it is to me.
Yeah. Now, is Tendu, we talked about expansion before. Is Tendu something you want to keep, in the right box, or is that something that, can expand? If people love it and there's demand, how do you handle that?
Well, we can make a certain amount of that. We're kind of at the point where We're gonna have to go out hunting for grapes if we want to expand it. We kind of like where it's at.
That's not a priority right now.
It's at a good spot. There's enough of it that we have our economy scale to get our price nice and low.
Right.
When Whole Foods last year Whole Foods did it in 130 stores, and we had enough wine to do that. We're not missing on great opportunities, so we're just going to kind of keep it the way it is.
Right.
You know, it's not, I don't want it to take over our life. It's just, it's supposed to be a fun thing.
Well, I think you figured out what you want to do and where you want to be, and it sounds like you're resisting a little temptation. You know, I mean, you have the product and you could create the demand, but it's important, you know, what you put out there.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, after talking to you and just a lot of my guests and research, you know, it just seems that sustainable and organic farm practices, you know, really paying attention out there is sort of the most logical path to making probably the best wines. I just, over and over, I mean, what's your take on why don't more people do it? Cost? Lazy? Yeah. Why wouldn't that eventually, like you said, people buy organic food or heirloom food? Because that's important. You're going to put a crappy bottle of wine on the table?
Yeah, exactly.
Or bad Pratt? You know, why?
Yeah.
What is it?
I don't know. You know, why organics it's fast growing.
But not even, don't even get stuck in organics. Sustainable. You know, proper practices and all that.
Well, you know, the industry, the wine grape industry has made huge improvements on sustainability over the last couple decades. It definitely has made huge inroads. The grape industry is a little unusual in that there isn't a whole lot of marketplace reward for being sustainable. So you're doing it, a farmer is doing it out of the goodness of their heart. You know, it's not, you don't have as much as you do with other food. You don't have as much of that price premium.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a good point. You know, people do things. They donate money to buildings so they can get their name up on the building. Other people donate anonymously because they just care about getting the building up. I guess what you're saying is if people sustainably farm and it doesn't matter, why would you do it?
Yeah, I mean, it's surprising how many people do it even though no one knows it.
I mean, in Bordeaux, a ton of the most famous wines are sustainable practicers.
Yeah.
But, you know, they don't flaunt that or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, so they're just doing it because it's the right thing to do. So it's surprising actually how many. So I'd like to see if there's more consumer push, that would be a good thing.
Right.
Because that's what's, you know...
I think
they're willing to vote there with their wallets, then that's what's going to drive practices.
You know, if you come to New York, you come to Brooklyn where we do our show, every other wine store is a natural wine store. Mm-hmm. The restaurants have lists. And they're not doing it just because it's hip. It's what people are asking for. They realize, you know, I want a bottle of wine that's been, you know, thoughtfully farmed, sustainable, you know, low intervention vineyard practices. I think we're on our way, but I think there's a process and it's going to take time, you know, with all of that.
It's really going to require the consumers continuing to ask those questions.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, I think we're on our way. All right, we're going to wrap up in a few minutes, but I want to do a couple of things. We do this thing called the wine list where I ask my guests a bunch of questions. I like to get their take on, you know, what they're drinking and some habits. And, you know, I'm more intrigued with you than most people, so I'm going to ask you that. But one last thing, you and Jill grow a bunch of fruits and vegetables. I mean, that's, you love that. And Jill, do you still sell stuff at farmers markets and make all these jams?
Last year, our kids took over the farmers market.
Right.
Jill was so proud.
Nice.
Yeah, they went and picked the fruit, took it to the farmers market, sold it all, and they volunteered to do it. So yeah, we were happy parents.
Nice. So in New York, there's the Union Square Farmers Market in the fall.
Every chef walks
through it. And that's their bounty for their menu. I would guess that if you put a table of stuff out, people know it's your stuff. I would guess anybody who's a chef or a cook, the chef's going nuts for your stuff.
We sell
right?
more stuff to restaurants than we do to the farmers market.
That's what I figured.
They know exactly
what you're doing. That's,
yeah, like sometimes we have a the problem is the fatted calf is a great great butcher, and they do here in Napa. And they wanted to make a Matarda from our peaches.
Really?
So we gave him a flat of peaches, and then he calls later in the day and he says, "We have a problem."
I need 60 more flats.
He said they were so delicious that the staff ate them all, and so we don't have any to make our Matarda.
Do you
have any
more? It doesn't even make it to the prize. Yeah, well, that's the problem when you're kind of doing local farming and all that. You know, you're not a big
agriculture. You can't have the staff eat your whole product.
Well, you'll always continue to do that, right? Take advantage of the land. It's a nice thing.
Yeah.
All right, I have a thing called the wine list. I just want to ask you about some of your wine habits, because you, like the rest of us, drink some wine. So let's give people a little peek into what you're doing. So the first question we ask people is, what are you drinking now? Are there things you're tasting or experimenting, or are you kind of like one thing's on the table more than something else?
Well,
or do you tend to drink the same stuff?
No, we never drink the same producer. I'm not even good at telling you the names of producers much, because I can never remember them all. But I try to regions, you know, and trying to, you know, because we want to explore and learn.
Right.
So we don't tend to buy a case of something.
Are you on a region right now?
But, I'm really into Riesling right now.
Me too.
Really into Riesling. I've been drinking a lot of sake, actually.
Me too. I just did a sake show.
Oh, man. It's clean. That snow melt. I'm a sucker for that snow. We had a master of wine from Japan come over, and he's tasting our wine, and he goes, I love the purity of the flavor of the water in your wine.
He could pick that up.
And I was sitting there going, wait, you know, because being a lover of sake, I knew exactly what he was saying. And I thought that is such a compliment. A lot of people would be like, what the hell, you're saying my wine tastes like water?
Yeah. But you knew exactly what he was saying. And he knew what he was saying.
Yeah, the purity of that water that
defines good
sake. Have
you ever had a Yamaha? It's this very earthy, musky sake.
Okay.
If when you get back, look for, ask for Yamaha. It's Yamaha. A style. I think Yamahai.
Got it.
It's a little different than some of the sakis. We did a tasting on air with a sake master and a woman who imports. All right, this is a silly question, but it's a wine question. Do you have a favorite wine and food pairing? Is there something that...
My favorite wine and food pairing. I mean, I love, we had really great Dungeness crab. That's Northern California.
So shellfish.
So Dungeness crab, we eat that cold, and we'll do that with Chardonnay.
American Chardonnay, Chablis, what?
Well, American Chardonnay, and, you know, and so, like, you know, we drink a lot of our friends' wine. So, like, you know, because, you know, so there's a lot of great wines right now going on in California.
Like Nathan.
Yeah, like Nathan. So we trade with them every year, have been for years. We have a nice little cellar that, like, I just got an email from Grand to Tomer saying, hey, you know, are my Matthias and stocks getting low? Are you ready for a trade? Trade with anyone you can trade with. You know, like, we'll trade with Raj and Sashi.
Right.
Trade with, you know, like the Sanford and Benedict Sandy Chardonnay has that richness with that acid. So with Dungeness crab, that's a really amazing pairing.
Okay, so a good Raj Parsandi shard with Dungeness crab.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Yeah. All right. Do you, I know you stay in a lot, but do you have a favorite wine restaurant or bar, I guess, in the area that does it well, has a good wine selection, that know it? You know,
that's
without leaving anyone out
that's
or incriminating
be tough
anyone.
They're all my friends. But, you know, like the newest one to open up that is, I think, is a game changer is Compline in Napa.
What's it called?
Compline, Compline.
And when you say game changer, they're doing something a little different than what everyone else?
Yeah, they're just, you know, it's wine. It's an international wine list that with a lot of really intellectual wines that are affordably priced.
But that's not a knock, but does everyone in Napa feel they need to support local winemakers and have a domestic list?
Well, it's extremely
if you work in Detroit and buy a Toyota, you know, you're like an asshole. Is it a bad thing in Napa? Everybody wants to try some of that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So it puts restaurants in Napa feel the pressure. And this is part of having a restaurant.
So they went in and broke it open.
Well, they have their domestics too. They've been running, but they've been running our Pinot Meunier by the glass now for 4 months.
Nice.
They're trying to mix it up. It's a Napa Valley Pinot Meunier.
Pinot Meunier is one of the famous blending grapes in Champagne. Everyone forgets Champagne's a wine. They put the bubbles in and all of that. All right, so that's a good one.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite all-time wine? Is there a wine that you tasted? It could have been a wine on your first date. It could have been a birth wine. Is there something that's just still oh wow to this day?
Favorite all time.
You may not. I'm not going to back against the wall if it's...
I mean, I have like some...
Or a few. You know, it doesn't have to come down to one.
Yeah, you know, that's a toughie. You know, like I always was partial like to the old, back when Mondavi was run by Robert, you know, and Tim Mondavi.
Are you talking 70s, 80s, yeah, 80s, 90s, yeah, early yeah, 90s, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so that, because the first great wine I ever had was the 1990 Mondavi Reserve Cabernet. Which was
the 87 was killer. I mean,
that's like a model for me,
right?
And you know, a lot of people, if they don't remember that era, wouldn't understand, because you know it's a very different winery now,
right?
But you know, the level
totally in every sense, ownership, yeah, vision, you know, product and all of that. So yeah, good old Mondavi Reserve.
Yeah. So like the 90, I was born in 69. My wife got that for a birth year wine for me when I turned 45.
Had a drink.
And
did
it
you
was
drink it?
Beautiful red cherries. Mm. You know, I just tasted the 72 Clos de Vaux Cabernet with Steven Spurrier, actually, during they were filming the Somme 3, and that was a really cool thing last week. And that was, it started out kind of leather and kind of a yellow curry. And I thought, we're going to see what this does in the glass. It might just drop off. And then all this red cherry came out.
It was so
vibrant. It was so nice. Vibrant. And 12.5 alcohol. And I was asking those guys, could you release a wine like this now? I mean, you know, like you wouldn't score well. I mean, like, because we're trying, you know, that's what we're trying to do. Those, but our wine is riper than that when that went into the bottle. Our cab is riper than that even. And that driving acid that wine had held it for 45 years.
Have you ever tried a 74 Heights Martha's Vineyard?
I don't know if 74, but the old Heights Martha Vineyards
they're pretty good.
Are pretty awesome.
Pretty good.
I mean, I love the eucalyptus.
Yeah, I mean, it's just...
I'm a sucker for...
It's like, you know it right away.
Yeah.
It's the craziest thing. All right, the last question we ask people, and I'm going to answer this for you, because we talk to a lot of Somme winemakers, people who are just around wine, and I always ask people, tell me about the best wine around $15, $20 retail. And I always preface it because I have kids in their 20s, mm-hmm, and they're going to dinners and they don't want to bring a crappy bottle, but they don't have the money to spend. You know, so what's the bottle? So I'm going to answer first, and if you want to throw in, I think the perfect answer for this is a 10-do red and a 10-do
white. Oh, there you go.
I think, you know, if you're really looking for well-thought-out, well-made, delicious, which is a great adjective for wines, you know, you could do 10-dos. Anything else come
to
mind?
That price point is tough in California.
Yes.
I mean, people do it.
Yes, and when I ask, you don't get a lot of cat. You get Muscadet and Loire,
yeah,
and Chinon from, you know, France.
Yeah.
but not a lot of
there's
Napa.
There's some folks are really shooting in for, you know, shooting in California are still trying to find that value category.
You
like,
did it.
You know, like Hobo is really trying to make affordable wines. But what I tell people is, my friends that are like, don't want to spend a lot of money on wine, is, you know, first off, you have to be in an independent wine shop.
Right.
And then look at turn the bottle around and look at the back label and find a wine that's in the price point you're looking for, and then see who imports it. And I get, you know, so it's like if it's Dresdner or Rosenthal or Jose Pastor, or, you know, chances are it's going to be a really good, real handmade wine. And if it's in that price point, just get it. It's, you know, so, you know, like I buy a lot of times by importer when I don't know the producer.
I agree.
You know,
New York, it's a lot easier because of availability. But where you are. But also, if you have a good wine store and the guy that's running it is kind of tuned in, and you ask him and, you know, tell him your taste, he's probably out there curating stuff and trying to get the Pastor and the Dresdner.
Well, you got to go to the independent
and all that. Right, right. So importer's an important thing, and I think, you know.
But, yeah, number one is going to your wine store and telling them what you're looking for.
Right, and I agree.
You know, as long as it's a small place where the person who you're talking to.
All right, we're going to wrap up.
Knows and cares.
We're going to wrap up. I really appreciate you sitting with me. And it was worth the time, like I said, chasing you around. And it was nice to catch up with you at the Charleston Wine and Food Festival. You're down here doing a couple of things, right? Tell me what you're doing.
I'm doing a dinner. I'm doing dinner tonight with Stephen Satterfield, which I'm really excited about. He did a dinner with him here a few years back that was just phenomenal.
At Zero George, right. They're doing a bunch of dinners down there. And are you doing another event?
And then tomorrow I'm doing an event with Anson Mills Green.
Oh, right.
I'm really excited about one as well.
When I saw that, I said, that makes sense.
I don't know if it was a coincidence, but, you know, because we've been growing Heritage Greens. Right. We've been playing with it. I've been doing corns. Last year we grew Red Fife wheat, actually, between the olive trees.
Right.
And so I'm really excited on that one.
That'll be great.
We're doing unicorn wine pouring. We call it unicorn wines. It's kind of silly. But at Monarch.
Monarch's a great store in town, a little north on King, I think. That'll be nice. So is it going to be you and some other people?
Yeah.
So it'll be a Charleston wine and food event?
Yep.
And it'll be a bunch of very cool wine guys pouring for a couple hours. That's when, Saturday?
That is tomorrow afternoon.
Friday afternoon. From when to when?
I need to look at my schedule.
All right. Well,
I said that I have a really good wife who keeps me organized?
Yeah. She's not here.
She's back home, and she's texting me with where I need to go and what I need to do.
That's all right. All right, listen. Steve Mathiasen from Mathiasen Family Winery, thank you for coming on The Grape Nation.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. We'll post Steve's wine list answers on our social media, Instagram and Facebook. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby, and you can now follow hashtags. So follow us at #TheGrapeNation and at Twitter at BenRuby. Thank you to our guest, Steve Mathiasen. Thank you to our engineer, Vitor, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam BenRuby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.